Why is it we humans get romanced by complexity when the answers can be found at a simple and practical level? This is the Simply Practically Human podcast, where the human manager, Mark Labasque, features experts who have a track record in humanizing workplaces, using simplicity and practicality as their go-to approach. It's all about getting back to what it is to be human and watch workplaces thrive rather than just survive.
Hey there, it's Mark Labusk here for the Simply Practically Human podcast. And you may recall, maybe about a month, 6 weeks ago, I had the guest Colin Newland on from the UK, and Colin's into the decrapification of work. But as we got into that episode, he introduced me to a book called How to Be More Pirate, or Be More Pirate at the time. That's the first book. The second book's called How to Be More Pirate. And such is Colin's generosity, he introduced me to Alex Barker, who is, along with Sam at Be More Pirate, is working with organisations around the world today on teaching them about how the pirate code and how pirates and the way that they went about what they did could be very, very useful as a learning tool for workplaces, particularly around change and around leadership. So Alex joins me today. And really why I wanted to get Alex on was because I wanted to go a bit more deeply into what Colin started to introduce, but have someone who is right in amongst this business day to day share a few stories and share a little bit more about why she has got involved with this movement, as they call it, the book that became a movement. Be More Pirate is now a worldwide movement, and share some stories in particular on the second book on how to be more pirate. And she shares a particular story in this episode, which is incredible. Some simple things that an organization went and did, learning from the book, and made such a significant difference to them. So today, Alex will explode a few myths about piracy. She'll talk a little bit about how pirates came to be, and will also share a little bit about why she's got involved in this organization. Very, very fascinating to think that a particular group of human beings, individuals, a group that they become, whatever you want to call them, who had such a tarnished reputation, and some of that of their own doing, and some of it from the doing of others, were able to, I guess, operate back 200 and 300 years ago in ways that perhaps we only dream about in some respects today, in the way that they set up their hierarchies and their structures, on the way that they embraced a whole lot of things that I won't go into now, that we're still trying to find our way to do that today. There's some really, really interesting little anecdotes here that are shared, some very, very simple and practical tools and tips that you can take after listening to this back into your office, back into your workplace, even back into your life, and do something with. So as I always say, sit back, take a few notes, be challenged, and be a bit more pirate. We'll catch you at the end. I'm delighted to be joined from London in the UK by Alex Barker, who is the lead of Be More Pirate, which started as a book and has turned into a movement. And Alex helps organisations in the process of change and by encouraging them to be more pirate. Alex, thanks for joining me.
Thanks very much, Mark. It's a pleasure.
I'm fascinated by this. I got a little introduction to the great work that you're doing through a friend, Colin Newland, who came on here and spoke about the decrapification of work, and he started to get into sharing a little bit about the pirate movement that he's become part of. I'd love you to, as we start off today, is just talk a little bit about what is this movement about, because most of the listeners would have a preconceived idea about pirates, which I think is not the one they should hold.
Yeah, and I'm very grateful to Colin for offering that introduction. He is one of our core pirates in our crew. So what does Be More Pirate mean? So the book was a business book. So it was intended to speak to businesses and look at the way that a lot of our organizational models and systems, and if you drill it down to just the day-to-day rules we're kind of living by, how a lot of them are now completely out of date. They were built sort of in the 20th century for 20th century conditions. And now we're in the 20th century, very, you know, heading towards the middle of it. And we're still not updating a lot of those rules. And the book explores I suppose, a sort of parallel between what happened in the 1700s in, well, the UK, or what was then the British Empire, with the golden age of piracy, and kind of draws a parallel to where we are today, where we're kind of shifting paradigms. And what the pirates did was essentially rewrite a lot of rules for living and working together. And Sam, as in the original book, Sam, the author of the book and my co-pirate, has used that to inform how we can look at business today and start to rewrite some of those rules using some kind of core principles. And in the original book, he talks about the five R's, which are rebel, rewrite, redistribute, reorganize, and retell. It's the only pirate joke in the book, the five R's, but it's a way of just looking at how you can sort of really change business. And what happened was lots of people started to, once they'd read the book, started to look at how they could practically apply that to their own business. What does it mean to reorganize your existing teams? What does it mean to start to redistribute power, devolve power to, you know, from leadership, so not have such hierarchical organizations? What does it mean to write a pirate code to figure out what that looks like? And what does rebellion mean? Like, what level of challenge and rebellion do we need in order to challenge power dynamics in an organization? And, you know, yeah, how far can you push it, really? And so that came out of the original book. And what I've done with Sam since in the 2 years that we've been working together is to just look at how that is realistically being done. So I started to pick up a lot of the messages he was getting sent from people and say, well, how are you rebelling? What kind of rules are you breaking? What really matters here? And we turn those into case studies and stories. And then we use those to inform other businesses who are looking to be more pirates. So, and I think what's really, really fascinating to me is, yeah, sort of busting a lot of the myths about pirates and really getting into what it means, what piracy meant. And I think we are primed to think of it to be more about the rebellion aspect, when actually a pirate didn't exist outside of a crew. You couldn't really be a lone rebel as a pirate. You were always within a sort of group dynamic or a collective. And that meant that pirates actually couldn't dominate or have sort of tyrannous working practices. So you couldn't have that really egotistical leader that you quite often, let's say, get in yeah. organizations. So they have put so many checks and balances in around power that the pirate dynamic was very, very different. And I think that's something that really surprises people. It's so much about teamwork and collaboration and understanding everybody has something to bring to the table. Everybody has different strengths. And whilst there's also roles and responsibilities for people, No one person dominates, and you can always vote people out if they're not doing their job, or they don't adhere to your code, or if they violate, yeah, some of the principles and values that you put in place. And it's just, yeah, it's very different to how we run modern organizations. So it's a really great model to go back to and use to inform a more progressive workplace, I think.
What a great introduction to it, because, you know, you talked about the myth of pirates or piracy, and there's, you know, the... Before I'd read the book, and even before Colin had spoken to me, like, you know, I'd read a bit about pirates, and then I since watched the documentary about them, which I know Sam's in and he comments through the documentary, but I did have a bit of a view about what they're all about. But what really struck me, and as you were speaking just then, was how similar the conditions they found themselves in, the pirates, with the system, to what we find ourselves in the workplace today. And I've read the book, the first book. I haven't got to the second book yet, but I love this idea of bringing it to life now, because there are some good examples in the first book. I think Sam's used some good examples, but the fact that you've been able to, you've heard back from people who have read it and then gone, hey, I've done something and here's what's happened out of that. I think that must feel so rewarding for the both of you to know that the message is getting out there. So I congratulate you on that. What I'd like to do to start with, though, is just let's get a bit of your backstory, if you don't mind, because I know we've had a chat before. You've ended up in this pirate crew, in this movement in the last sort of 3 years or so, but how did you find yourself getting yourself to this stage where it's, you know, maybe the system you were working in wasn't giving you the satisfaction or helping you with your passions that you had?
So I think that I always had an interest in how systems work, or what the rules are, let's say. I studied Well, I had a dual interest, both in storytelling and in system change, I suppose. I guess that was reflected very early on because I studied literature and then I studied politics, specifically sort of international politics. And so, I mean, that's why I really love the storytelling element of Pirates and using that as a vehicle to help make change happen. But yeah, when I studied politics, I was always struck by this feeling that this just didn't really make sense to me. And that we were sort of using textbooks that were drawing on theories written in the 1970s and using them to understand our economic systems. And this, you know, is a period of very rapid change. The internet, I think, it was at the beginning of social media when I was at university. And that was a huge shift in terms of how we were starting to communicate. So I could sense, and I think that period of time when I was at university, there were these big global shifts going on around me because we had the financial crisis as well. It was 2008. And I could sense the world changing. And then I was looking at these books and going, they're telling me this is how it works. And I'm going, well, is this how it works? But I didn't have the confidence. I think this is really key. I didn't have the confidence to challenge or question any of the assumptions that I was being taught by people I assumed would know the answers because they'd spent their career studying this. So I went on and I ended up getting a job, several jobs later, lots of unpaid internships later in the charity sector, because I really wanted to do something that I thought would start to help solve some of the big global problems I was learning about around poverty and gender inequality and all these things that felt like a worthwhile thing to do with my life. And obviously at the same time, realizing I very much felt that I had no specific skills to offer other than a generic sort of intelligence. And I didn't really know where to put myself. I just, you know, you just throw yourself into anything. I was pretty much like, just give me a job. I'll do whatever. And I ended up in a social care charity, which was a fascinating insight into frontline problem solving in our healthcare system. And then I ended up in a think tank for 7 years, which was it's a hybrid between a think tank and a membership organization and a charity. So it was doing a lot of things at once. And it was great in so many respects. I started to hone my specialism. I was like, okay, communication is what I'm good at, I think.
Yeah.
And that was drawing on my original interest in the storytelling and how do you communicate change in a way that it really lands with people, coupled with gaining some technical skills as well. But over time, I just became quite disillusioned and I didn't really realize it was happening until it hit a real wall. It was just too much talk and not enough action, not serious action. What I could see happening was, again, it was these big seismic shifts in what was going on around us. You know, it was 2016 when we had the Brexit vote and I was surrounded by social researchers and nobody predicted that result, that we were going to leave the European Union. And I thought, what are we missing? We are missing something. We are not looking in the right places for answers, I think. And no shame or anything on anyone there, but it just struck me that something was amiss. And I realized that the kind of change that we were going to need in order to solve the big problems we were always talking about, whether it was climate change, inequality, democracy, was not going to come from institutions anymore. And I was in an institution, you know, it really was. It was very wedded to informing policy, influencing government. And I thought the change is going to come from somewhere more fringe, more radical. But I didn't really know where to go at that point at all. Because I was so in it, you know, I was so inside of it.
Yep, right in the middle of it.
Yeah. So I just thought, well, I'll cut loose for a bit. And I was also really burnt out. I would say that's a big personal thing for me. And something I've read about in recent years that's important in terms of seeing yourself within the system. I realized that I had, since I was a child, been trying to optimize myself to make myself as productive as I could possibly be, because that's what I'd been brought up to believe was the right thing. And that was what would make me successful. And I had quite competitive schooling. And we grew up with the narrative that if you work really hard, you'll become successful. You'll be able to buy a house. You'll have this sense of stability that was offered to our parents' generation and pretty much happened. But then as you could see that things weren't quite going that way. And I knew it from coming out of university into a big financial crisis. And then you're seeing house prices rise, and the fact that it was almost virtually impossible to get a job unless it was a really well-paying job and simply be able to save that money in order to gain that level of security.
Yeah.
I can see this path doesn't work anymore, but our mindset hasn't adapted to a new reality. Or a lot of people in my age bracket were still very much bought into that myth and really working hard. And like, you could see people burning out left, right, and center, working really long hours. And now we had all of our emails on our phones, so we were switched on all the time. And to the point where I realized, I feel better when I'm working than when I'm not working. In my body, like, my body is like, likes the feeling of being productive and smashing through tasks. So I sort of thought, I so mentally can't switch off. So the break was about that. And then that was when I came across Be More Pirate. I was on a sabbatical. I did know about the book because my workplace used to host events where speakers would come in and sort of do an overview of their book. And Sam had come to talk, but I hadn't paid any attention to it because I just couldn't compute anything at that point. I think I was burnt out. But I had downloaded the book on my Kindle because I thought it looked like something I should read. Like, it looked like I probably need some of this energy. But I couldn't get through the first three pages because it just seemed like it was going to be a book about social change. And I just didn't have any belief that that was possible, because I didn't believe that the people talking about it had any real investment in it, in making that kind of change happen. They just wanted to talk about it.
I love how you talk about, I guess, the system is such that I often say to people that the very people or the system, or however we want to talk about it, that espouses the change is the very one that's trying to keep everything exactly the same as it's been, because we're change resistant, but we're more loss avoidant as a species. So people were going to lose a lot of whatever it was, identity, reputation, status, whatever it could be. So, and I still think this goes on. And as you were talking, and I'm thinking about the workplace, and I've written about the 100-year-old management system, which is all still based around technical competence and work hard, be productive, be good at what you do, and then you'll get promoted, and you'll continue to get promoted, and then you'll earn that money so you can buy that house that you want to buy. And that's why I love the work that you're doing, because in essence, what you're sharing with people and teaching them is that there was a group of human beings a few hundred years ago who actually worked this out. They'd worked out that the system was trying to stay like the system was, and they rebelled against the system. But I want you to share, if you wouldn't mind, is why is it that pirates have got such a bad name? Because they sort of have, like, it's the sort of murderous, cutthroat villains that they were. Why have we continued to give them such a bad name, do you think?
Well, there's two reasons. And the first one is that they created that themselves. So pirates wanted to embellish their reputation to protect their bottom line. They deliberately created the Jolly Roger as a symbol that would drive fear into the heart of their enemies. So if you saw the skull and crossbones on the horizon, you would likely surrender rather than risk getting into a very, very brutal battle. So, yeah, they created this reputation through various storytelling techniques and symbolism. And some of the pirates really took that to an extreme and lived out the brand in a way that, you know, if they did come across them, they would be violent.
Yeah.
But it was rare. The violence wasn't their first sort of port of call at all. They really just tried to create the reputation in order to not get into battle. So that was the first reason why they got the reputation, because they were trying to create it themselves so that they would be left alone. But also then, obviously, the establishment at the time, it was in their interest too to make pirates feared and seem as unpalatable as possible, so that the public would see them as the enemy and see the hanging of pirates and the hunting of pirates as a legitimate thing, rather than what the pirate's story, which was come and join us, we'll give you a better life. Yeah, so it was a bit of a standoff between, in the way that we see in today, still, like, it's a storytelling standoff, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Whose story is going to win out? And I think the thing is, unfortunately, the establishment story won out, that we believe that pirates are inherently bloodthirsty and I don't want to use the word evil because it's a bit of a funny word, but yeah, they're the villains.
And it's interesting how the system seems to continue to win out. I know there's lots of movements and pushing at the system and pushing hard at the edges of the system and maybe pushing even right through the system at times. And the system seems to bounce back really well. It seems to keep bouncing back. It's almost like, you know, you think of global financial crisis and other things and people are like, it's all going to be different now. I have a view that the system is very good at hiding in the shadows for a while when there's all of this noise going on, but it knows exactly when to show back up again and to do its thing. And that sort of leads me into how did the system respond, the establishment, how did it respond? You just talked about the public hangings. What else was the system doing to respond to the pirates in a way that the system today responds to any sort of pushing at the edges of it? Have you got any thoughts around that?
Yeah, I was thinking about this earlier, and the story of piracy is a bit complicated because in the beginning, if we're going to talk about the origins of the golden age of piracy, the piracy that happened in Britain at the time, it began with this complicated sort of legitimization of piracy via Queen Elizabeth I, who was trying to build back the country after Henry VIII's reckless spending. And so she kind of allowed piracy, and they called them privateers then because they were doing the Queen's bidding, but she wouldn't always necessarily admit to it to the King of Spain that they were plundering Spanish vessels out in the Caribbean. She'd sort of turn a blind eye and say, no, I would never allow that. And yeah, very likely she was just saying, go forth, take what you can. So how the system responded to piracy? Well, interestingly, there's a kind of very fluid back and forth between, yes, if you're going to help us, then we would like you to steal, and but not when it's threatening to us, not when you're outwardly taking from our stores. So I think that kind of happens today. I think we allow a little, you know, there's a sense that some disruption, if it serves the interest of the establishment, is allowed until it doesn't serve their interest anymore. And I think you see that in organizations. They go, okay, if you're going to be innovative, come up with some good stuff, and that's going to make us more profit, go for it. But they don't allow it for the sake of pure change. That's what I see. Because organizations are still, by and large, profit-driven rather than purpose-driven, they don't allow for change that is purely for purpose as much.
I love how you've drawn the parallel between 200, 300 years ago and today, because we're going to let you go out and steal if it serves us well. We're going to try this new thing if it makes us more bottom line. But the moment that it works against us, we're going to crack down. And that is so true of workplaces and organizations today. When you are, and look, I don't have any issue with organizations making profit. I do have a question they ask, though, is how much is enough?
Yeah.
And so what you've just shared then is absolute gold here, because the system is still sort of got its nose in front in some respects. If this is a race, the system has found a way over 300 years to continue to keep itself in front there. In the book, there's some pirate facts that come up about the way that they were ahead of their time, and even to the fact that they'd still be, in some things they did, maybe even ahead of the times of today. So what were some of the things the pirates were doing back then in the way they were setting themselves up, and even some of the things that they were allowing to happen that that we're still grappling with as society today? This is fascinating.
It is, and it's so remarkable that you're right. They are actually ahead of where we are today in a lot of places. So pirates, you know, had, first of all, real democracy. So decision-making was done through consensus. Rather than have the leadership make the decisions for the working conditions, the pirate code was all the rules, or articles as they called them, were voted on by everybody. And even if one person disagreed, they didn't go in the code. And it was just to prevent conflict primarily. The risk of mutiny at sea was so risky that they would do anything to mitigate that risk. Similarly, that's why they had transparent and equal pay, because people would inevitably fight about money if people felt that they were getting, some people were getting more. So the captain and the quartermaster and the roles that had more risk and responsibility got a little bit more, but not much more, like two times more than everyone else. Not like the CEO pays you see today. Again, so it's like, I read this the other day that David Miliband, who's a former politician here who runs the International Rescue Committee, was earning $1 million in the US and they have unpaid internships. And there's a question around, you know, come on. Like, I mean, you just have to ask yourself the question, are you okay with that? And you can tell that those decisions aren't made with everybody's input. So those are a couple of things. And they also had health insurance, a form of it, social insurance. So if you get actual monetary compensation if you were injured in a pirate battle. So it incentivized people to fully partake in everything that they were doing. You know, you wouldn't get people sort of running below deck and hiding because they knew that they would be looked after. They would be not left for dead, which you would be in the Navy. Although, you know, obviously no one wants to lose a leg or anything. There was a sense that you would be compensated for anything that happened to you. Again, like, you know, you look at the USA and they can't even get universal basic healthcare sorted.
Yep.
The premium on your life is that's quite remarkable. Pirates had same-sex marriage, a legal ceremony that recognized same-sex relationships that had an inheritance clause in it so that if one of the pair died, the other one would get the share of the money that they'd accumulated. So there was a really, you know, recognized as a kind of formal contract, not just a sort of we accept it. It was like we will celebrate it and give you recognition in a sort of legal way, which again is, you think, at what point in the UK we started to accept homosexual marriage and civil partnerships? It's unbelievable.
Yeah, a bit the same here as well. The other one that fascinated me was, and I know if I think about the documentary I watched, there was a lot of the slave ships that were coming through the area and the pirates being one of the first groups, if not the first group, to provide that sort of equality and the freedom by saying, come and join us. Like, we're not fussed about your colour and all of those sorts of things. You're humans. That's amazing as well, given some of the things that are still going on today.
Yeah, and I think that there's arguments to be made when you look at the source texts and you look at the people who've written about pirates more extensively than Sam and I have, even around how much pirates did things for moral reasons and how much pirates did things because it suited their overall purpose, which was to be able to plunder more ships. But then the two things sort of went in hand, like, you know, they were seeking more money to distribute to their crew. And because they had those democratic clauses in place, if you were on a pirate crew, you would get that share. And that included, yes, freed slaves. And they would say if anyone who wanted to join a pirate crew was welcome. So they didn't have any qualms about your socioeconomic background, your colour, even your gender. They allowed female pirates, even though there was the myth that women would bring bad luck to sailors. They ignored all of that and would happily have anyone who had skills.
I was particularly Anne Bonny.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it's incredible to, I must get and read up some more about Anne Bonny. I just, again, watched the documentary and thought.
Yeah, so Anne Bonny is depicted in that documentary, though, still not very true necessarily to how she was. You know, she's seen as very seductive in that documentary, and that isn't necessarily how she always was. Mm. So I was speaking to another woman who's written a lot about Anne Bonny, and we were talking about that kind of depiction of. And the fact that in that documentary, so Anne Bonny pretty much came hand in hand with Mary Read, who is her, or very likely her lesbian partner. But they also both had relationships with men too. So they were both, they dressed as men and women, and they also had relationships with men and women. So it was very fluid and nobody was bothered about any of that. But the fact that they missed out Mary in that documentary just shows again, like, you've missed out a really crucial pirate in history. And they have a fascinating story. And yet why are we still missing out the female heroines with a fascinating story to tell? That struck me when I was watching that.
I must read up some more then, because if that's the case with that documentary, there's a lot more strings to the bow than I saw. Hey, let's take it into the practical now. And I'm interested to, with your second book, How to Be More Pirate, like, I love the idea of let's get some real stories now, because, you know, the first book's a great read and people would read it and be like, this is great and I'm really fired up. And now, like you said earlier, I didn't have the confidence to do anything back when you were, you know, in your early formative years in your career. You just sort of stay with the system. But people have become inspired by what the writings in the first book, and they've gone out and tried some things, which I think is amazing. Are you able to share maybe one of the stories that really has inspired you that's come back through to say, hey, we read the book, we did this, this is what happened, thank you very much?
Absolutely. There's lots of different stories in there that I love and are close, that kind of see the pirate story the whole way through. But the one I'll share, I think, is the one near the beginning. And I think it speaks to me because it's from the charity sector and that was where I came from. And that particular mutiny against the way that charities operate spoke to me. And it was one of the first stories I also heard. So it's in the chapter on how live by the code. So one of the first pirate codes, and this, again, I was going through all the messages that Sam had been receiving from people, and people were actually sending their new pirate codes. And the pirate code that had been created by this particular organization was so sophisticated and well thought through and, yeah, just incredible. I think it's, you know, it's almost better than the original pirate codes in terms of figuring out your values and then working out how you live by them. And so it came from an organization called the Child's Rights International Network, which is a human rights NGO as well. So I think it struck both Sam and I that this is a really serious area. Talking about human rights and the interaction with legality in that. So they thought, they think that pirates and pirate language and the pirate code is needed. We started to take it more seriously and that, you know, this is really applicable. And what was amazing about the story was so many parts of it. First of all, how they got to the pirate code. So she used a couple of kind of facilitation techniques to invoke a bit of jeopardy to her team. And we always talk in workshops about asking more uncomfortable questions because you're trying to get people into that pirate space of like, you're going to have to be more uncomfortable with uncomfortability in order to be pirate and to make real change. And she said to her team, what would happen if we shut down in 6 months? Just hypothetically, she's like, the problem is that we are a charity. And are we just entrenching the status quo? Because most organizations tend to do that. And what we say we're about change, but are we really changing anything? Are we just saying the same things as everybody else, trapped in funding cycles? How do we break free of that? And so by putting that question on the table, they looked at all their work and they were like, this is the stuff that's really game changing. The rest of it can kind of fall away. So let's just get rid of all that stuff. And then even people who are doing that work, there was like voluntary redundancies as a part of that process, which I thought was really radical. And then they got to this core work and they realized this is the stuff that's going to make us stand out. And they started to campaign on much more radical issues like lowering the voting age here, which again is like a bit contentious, and things like the forced sterilization of children with learning disabilities, which is a practice that still happens and nobody wants to talk about it. It feels very taboo. And they thought, we're going to go out on the fringes. And as a result, they actually got more funding. The donors they were using were started to take more notice and said, actually, this is interesting. You're doing something quite different to the other NGOs we're seeing. So that idea of going to the edges of the map, which is what they did,
yeah,
being willing to be those pirates, actually helped their cause. And I think that's the problem most organizations are in, is if we go there, we'll lose all our funding, we'll lose our reputation, we'll lose our relationships, and that's too much risk to take. But it can work in quite the opposite direction. So that came full circle.
I love that. It was interesting when I spoke to Colin, he came on the podcast and he talked about almost the opposite to what you've just described, which is every year most organizations go on an offsite to write a 5-year plan.
Yeah.
But they do that every year. So it doesn't even get past year one, really. It's just that's it. Whereas taking it to the edge, like this organization, like what if we're not here in 6 months' time? Like, what would happen? Well, and getting them really focused in on the work of being comfortably uncomfortable is a great thing. The other thing I loved, I listened to you and Sam in your podcast the other day, and I think Sam might have said it or you said it, but you don't refer to yourselves as consultants, but insultants. And I love that because, and I think Sam said, or you said it, like, if we're going out to encourage people to go on mutinies, we are going to, in some respects, insult them or create a level of discomfort. But that seems to be what is maybe resonating with readers of your books, is that this work is not easy work. this is systemic change work, and it's not the usual stuff of we'll write a 5-year plan, but we'll come back to it in 12 months' time. I love that story. I think, and then you said the rewards came to them. They started to get more funding because they went to the edges of the map. I think that's fantastic. Rebel, rewrite, and retell were three of the five that really struck a chord with me. One of the things you just shared is really a practical tip for organisations and for workplaces is you need to go to the edge of your comfort to start to find these things. Are there some other things you can share, this like really practical things that you can share with the listeners to say, if you be more pirate, and I'm going to say, and I love what you had, taking rule breaking from risky to responsible as well, what would be some of those simple and practical tools or tips that you would share with the listeners to embrace this being more pirate?
Yes. I'll even break down the edges of the map a little bit more, because when we do workshops, I do, because, you know, even if you say like, oh, get to the edge of your comfort zone, people go, I didn't, how? We're not necessarily even aware of what the edges is. So I break it down and say, look at what feels like a taboo subject and then start to come up with some difficult or uncomfortable questions to ask. And that usually helps them to understand what is at the edges, what is taboo. And then I say, well, you know, who is off the edges of your map? Who do you never talk to? Just come up, list some people that you've never spoke, types of people you've never spoken to. How could they give you a totally different perspective on some of the things that you're working on or a challenge? Because we talk about diversity endlessly, but actually what we're really trying to get to here is the value in diverse life experience.
Yep.
You can't access the feeling of what it feels like to have, you know, had a serious illness, for example, but, you know, you could talk to someone who did, and that would be off the edges of the map for you. And it could open the doors for so much rich content and understanding. And then where do you go? Where could you go to give you fresh inspiration? You know, we're very influenced by our environment. If you stay in the same place all the time, you're going to think the same. And what you're trying to do is internalize a pirate spirit, but, you know, internalize innovation in a sense, an innovative like way of being and thinking. And that's what's going to continually help you to come up with those new ideas and things. That's how I break it down. And then the other thing I'd say is we always talk about small bold actions because for various reasons, when we started to use the questions in the original book, what rule would you break and rewrite? People would go too big and too vague. That's like just a standard thing that humans do when they are asked those questions, I think. So, you know, you've got to work backwards from that. If your vision is to create a whole new program that will solve the problem you've identified, you can't just do that overnight. It's going to take you months. So what is the small, bold action that you're going to take in the next 48 hours that will start to move the needle on that vision? And usually it's really simple. Who could you email? Somebody who you've never spoken to before, or is maybe several layers above you and you feel like they wouldn't respond, or they're not accessible, or they might reject your proposal. That's where you need to be, in that kind of not so risky that it causes any anxiety or that you're really putting anything in jeopardy at this stage, because you don't want to do that too soon. That's too much too soon. But it's got to be something that makes you feel a bit like I risk some level of, you know, rebuttal.
Yeah.
But you're taking a chance. You're taking a something that's outside of the norm. And what I would say is it's not even that action needs to succeed. It might be that you fall, you know, they say no. But what you're trying to do is start to flex a muscle, a new muscle for taking a bit of a chance or taking a risk where you wouldn't always. And that it's the change that happens in you that is the most important thing. That's what we're trying to get to. So just identifying some small, bold actions that you could take. And it creates momentum as well. It's about not going away after that away day that Colin talked about and going, oh, well, what do we do next? Or, okay, that was really inspiring and great, but like, you know, this is going to take ages. This is a lot to do on top of our usual work. So yeah, those small, bold actions are critical, I think.
I love it. And a third thing, what would be another thing that you would say?
Well, I would have started at the beginning, which is like figuring out your pirate code.
Some
core principles the small bold actions are almost how you live the pirate code. Like that's where you'd be starting from. So there's an example in the second book where a team's principle was like, we want to bring the soul back to work.
Yep.
And I was like, that's a great principle, but what does that really mean on a day-to-day level? And what they did was they said, well, the thing that sucks the soul out of our work in the first instance is our email culture. Like, it's just endless, draining. And so they created four new rules around email culture that they put as bullet points at the bottom of their signature. Yep. So that every time you send an email, you're reinforcing the new culture. Because you're saying, this is what we think about emails. This is how we should change it. Things like, don't deliver bad news by email. You know, we've all had those passive aggressive emails that are like, those sort of things where you go, oh, that kind of stung a bit. But we haven't had it. Again, to speak to being human, we've had no human to human contact. You're just kind of, So that was a small bold action. It was a practical way that they could live their code. So the idea, you know, again, what Colin said about, it just becomes an away day that you then you write some stuff out and then it just goes in the drawer. And then that's why you have to revisit it the next year. A code is so different. It's a living thing. It's expressed day to day. And that's why the original pirates couldn't be caught with a pirate code on them. So they had to know it. They had to know it inside out.
Yep.
And that's what we're aiming for. We're aiming to have a sense of like, we know who we are. We know what we stand for. We know how we adhere to it. And it helps us to make decisions.
I find the small, bold action one, they're all fascinating, but in particular, like, and again, thinking about those, you know, days away, those off-sites is they come up with their BHAGs, their big, hairy, audacious goals. And, you know, all those things are nice to have. They're sort of nice to put there. But I also wonder when people set too big a goal for themselves. So you put a target on your back. But secondly, sometimes perhaps we set them because we know we're not going to achieve them and we can go back to what we were doing is another way. And when they're vague, I think that's absolute work avoidance. It's like, let's just create a really wanky corporate statement about maybe put innovation in there and a few other words in there. And then all of a sudden it becomes something that doesn't mean anything. It's a bit like your code. When you write a code, it should be short, sharp and succinct. And it's like, yep, I don't deliver bad news over an email. That's easy to understand, but we tend to make things either they're too big and we can't achieve them, or they're very vague, so it keeps everybody, the system or the establishment keeps people where they want them to be. Very, very clever. Thank you for those. Now, I want you to, if you wouldn't mind, now you may have a very different view on this than what I do, and I hope that if you do, you share it boldly as the pirate that you are. I have a view that we try and turn simple into complex, and notwithstanding humans are complex and whatnot, but we tend to walk past simple things. Like the simplicity of don't send bad news in an email, that to me that's a simple thing. But we might try and complicate that or make that more of a complex policy or whatever it might be. My view is we are romanced by the flame of complexity because it does a whole lot of things for us. But I'm interested in your view around that. Do you think we try and turn the simple into complex? And if you think it from a pirate perspective, were they good at the simple stuff, and or was it more complex or complicated than I'm giving it kudos for?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that the world is complex. When I say complex, I mean it is a ongoing chain of reactions and interactions that feel complex to human beings. And I think sometimes we though that we imagine a complex situation requires a complex answer, and it doesn't always. And I think, pirates didn't do that, because really all you're ever doing is living moment to moment. I think what pirates had on their side was urgency and sort of a sense of jeopardy that we don't have very often now. You know, when you're forced into a crisis situation, you have to make a decision and you have to just work out what to do. And usually that doesn't involve creating some kind of complex plan. It means a series of small or simple actions that you have to take. So I think that's a big thing, that we are quite often in a sense of stasis, and that allows us to ruminate on complexity quite a lot. And then I think there's if I'm go back to what I see working with organizations, is we have created a professionalization of work, which as a baseline, you know, requires jargon or you to use certain kinds of mediums in order to retain a particular identity. And I think that complexity becomes a signifier of status.
Yes.
So actually a lot of organizations aren't that geared towards problem solving until it's urgent. We're actually geared towards securing our own identity moment to moment. And that's what work really is, rather than, yeah, like I said, real problem solving until you have to do it. So I think that's why we get sort of become wedded to complexity, because it becomes part of our identity.
Yeah, I've heard that one before as well. Certainly there is complexity, there's no doubt, but there's something in us about identity, status, whatever we want to call it, that, you know, I want to be smart, and if I can make something really complex and then solve it, then I can get the seat at the big table. Because that's where we sort of all want to, we all want to end up. Let's wrap it up with the movement. So how do people join your movement? If there's a few pirates out there, they're not quite pirates yet, but they're like, yep, I'm thinking about getting on board. What's a good way to get on board the pirate ship with Alex and Sam and Colin and the rest of these pirates? And are there any pirates in Australia yet? Have you recruited some over here?
Yeah, there are actually. We're going to be doing a webinar in August and a couple of events next year for pirates in the education sector in Australia. So education leaders, well, hopefully they'll become pirates, because there's a case study in the book of a school in Adelaide that is very pirate. It's probably the first pirate school, so definitely some pirates down under. But to get involved, well, I usually just sort of point people to the website. It really depends on where you're at and on what you'd like to get out of it. I have a network map on the website, which doesn't quite cover like even half the network really, but it's a lot of people who actively added themselves and shared information about themselves. So you can sort of browse that and see who's in the network. There's a link to our meetup page. I do regular community events for people to come and join, and just some of them are just very casual, conversational about different issues. I do some with Colin around specifically workplace stuff, but then people are always welcome to just connect with me personally. I run a network unusually, I think, in that I like personal connection. I think it's important. I don't want to grow exponentially through newsletters and pipelines and all of that. It's just, that's bollocks. So I love to hear the personal stories. If the book has affected you, or you've got a story and you think you're pirate and you're trying to do something, then I always, always want to hear that story. I'd rather that 10 people did something game-changing than we have a massive newsletter and I don't know anyone.
I love it. How human of you, how humanly pirate of you to want people to connect with you. And I'm sure they can find you on LinkedIn as well, if it's not on the on the website and those sorts of things. Alex, look, thanks for coming on today. You've filled in a lot of gaps. Colin started the appetite, whetted the appetite for me. Mm-hmm. I had a read of the book, and you've certainly been able to, I think, really, really well articulate to the listeners today about, you know, just the simple things that you can do, the small, bold actions, the pirate code, doesn't have to be big, and looking at what are the taboo questions that you should start to ask in order to make the progress that you want. So love you sharing those things, and wish you and Sam well on your crusade. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
What a fascinating conversation that was with Alex. A couple of things that really stood out for me there in what she was talking about was her own self-awareness of her time in the system. And she said she was in the system and she lacked the confidence to challenge. But then in the end, she said, facing into burnout, she cut loose and she sort of got herself out of that system and started to look around for what else was out there. You know, the diverse life experiences that she's had, and also talking about the sort of the life experiences and the way that the pirates went about what they did, some real similarities there. Asking uncomfortable questions, starting to create environments where, if we call it looking at what's taboo, and that's a bit of what the pirates did, is start to ask those questions like, what would happen if we weren't here in 6 months' time? And start to focus in on the sort of work that's important, and not maybe that periphery work that you're doing. Getting to the edge of the map rather than staying in the middle is something that I picked up there. Small, bold actions was a really important piece there too. Don't go too big, or don't be too vague. And I think that's, in some respects, a way we keep ourselves from changing, is we go with something really big that we'll never achieve, and we lose our focus and, I guess, our desire and motivation to do that. Or we go with something that's really vague, knowing full well that no one really understands it and nothing will come from it. And then that last one about, you know, writing that pirate code, that simple example she gave around the 4 dot points for an email. And you know, whether we send an email or whether we don't, we don't send an email when it's bad news. It's really, really simple and practical. Her thoughts around the link between status and identity and how we see ourselves and how we were seen by others if we go more to complex than to simple. Again, some words that I've heard from other people in the past. And just the passion that came through in the stories that Alex was sharing. And one of the things I really encourage you to do is if you do have some stories of some things that you've done, if you've not had a look at the books to start with, have a look at the books. But if you have a story where you've done something a little bit pirate, you know, you have looked at breaking some rules, but responsibly breaking some rules, and you got some great outcomes from that, as Alex said, reach out to her and share some stories with her because they're the sorts of things that they love to hear about. You can also get in touch with them through their website, which is Be More Pirate. And as Alex said, just reach out to her because she loves to connect. Hey, if you like this one, why not rate it 5 stars? And if you loved it, share it with your friends. But until next time, keep it simple, keep it practical, and keep it human. Bye for now.